Hello, welcome to this week's episode of the Apartment Academy podcast, the apartment industry's only operations-focused podcast and your institute of higher NOI. This week, your dean, that's me, Daniel Cunningham with the Apartment Academy, is en route to Redcon in New York, where we're going to be talking about insurance and risk management. In the meantime, I wanted to go ahead and record the intro of Jared Hutter. Jared is the founder and chief snow shoveler for Aptitude Development. And if you are interested in understanding better about the economics behind student housing, the operational elements of student housing, it's a product type not a lot of people understand, but it's very attractive economically. And you're going to find out that today. So here is Professor Hutter. Hello, Professor Hutter. Welcome to the hallowed halls of the Apartment Academy. It's great to have you.
Thank you for having me, Dan.
So, Jared, you are the co-founder and now chief snow shoveler at Aptitude Development. Let's talk a little bit about chief snow shoveler. I got to know what does that mean? I can guess culturally the tone you're trying to set here, but lay it on us.
So it really evolved from two origins that kind of converged. The first one was when I was a little over 10 years ago or so, when I was breaking off to start my own company. One of the things I was doing was I was meeting with a lot of real estate professionals, you know, big time people. I was living in New York City. I was lucky enough to have access to, you know, some big household names. And I was meeting with one of them one day, seeing the operation. None of them were in student housing. I had wanted to break into student housing, but I certainly knew, you know, let's understand how to run a business at the end of the day. And I'm sure we'll get into it. My opinion is real estate is real estate. But I was meeting with a big time real estate professional who told me when he first started in the business that, you know, he was kind of known as like the chief dishwasher, right? And explaining, and this guy's worth billions of dollars. And he's explaining how, you know, at the beginning he was doing everything, right? And there was a family portfolio there. So it wasn't like you necessarily start at the top. And I never forgot that, right? You know, thinking this person who's, you know, very, very successful, you know, originally called himself the dishwasher. So I always remembered that. Then fast forward a couple years later. So this is probably the beginning of 2018. We were building our second building in Syracuse, and we were using what was called the Prescient system, which is a looks like an erector set that goes up, flies up real fast. It's a prefabricated steel system. And so we were building seven stories of this, basically an erector set on top of a one-story concrete podium. It's the coldest winter in 114 years up in Syracuse. And I get up there. I had nothing else to do. So, you know, we had one job going on at the time. We had sold our first job. So I'm constantly on site, the same as I was on the first one, knew where every nail and, you know, screw was on those jobs. So I'm always up there. And I get up there, the concrete pad had been poured on the second floor, and I see these guys not working. You know, we've got a really tight schedule to make, and I see them not working. So I was talking to our site super, and he's like, yeah, you know, it was actually union carpenters who were doing the work. We didn't need to build union, but they were the most skilled to put this set up. So the Prescient company subbed it out to these union carpenters. And like I said, it was the coldest winter in 114 years, snow all over the place. And, you know, I'm getting nervous and getting annoyed because we got a schedule to keep. These guys aren't working. So I said to the site super, I said, you know, what's going on? He just said, well, and I'll probably butcher the numbers a tiny bit, but it was something along the lines of the extension cord that was there to melt the snow and keep these guys warm was 26 feet long. And OSHA regulations said it could only be 24 feet long. Again, I may have the numbers slightly off, but it was very close. So I asked the question. I said, so you're telling me if the snow goes away, then these guys will get back to work. And he's like, that's what they say. You know, no one really knows. So I was like, give me a shovel. So I start shoveling the snow. And then these guys had no excuse to not go back to work. So they were still cold, but the snow was gone and they were able to get back to work because they were bitching that the extension cord was slightly too long. That was A, keeping them warm, and more importantly, from my perspective, melting the snow so these guys could actually work. So that's, I always remembered that. I was always talking about it. And a couple years ago, I was like, might as well just sort of, you know, make it with the chief snow shoveler. It's on the business card, it's on the website. You know, legitimate title at this point, which I guess, you know, you can kind of make up anything you want, but, you know, I think there's two origins to it that really go. And, you know, I think you alluded to this before, it really sets the culture, right? Like, you know, we're a small organization, right? There's 7-8 of us, you know, in the office. And the idea is it's all hands on deck, right? There's roles, responsibilities, everyone's got, you know, what they need to do. But at the end of the day, it's an all hands on deck, right? And if I need to go back out there and shovel snow, yeah, so be it, right? Like There's nothing that I won't do to ensure the success for our projects, our company, and our investors.
Yeah, emblematic of every great, I think, small company, startup company. Same over here on the Leonardo 24/7 side. But let's talk a little about the company for a moment. Size. You mentioned student housing. We're going to talk about that today. But sort of your focus is student housing. How many development projects have you done? How many do you have right now that you're operating?
Yeah, so we started the company almost 10 years ago, right? I'm not sure exactly when this will play, but April 2nd is my job quitting day that I celebrate on my calendar every year. So April 2nd this year will be 10 years. So we've been on this journey now for 10 years, and we just recently broke ground on our 11th and 12th ground up developments. One's a fairly large deal, the biggest one we've ever done from a dollars perspective, in the sexiest market we've ever been to, which is Arizona State. And then we've got one that's kind of on the complete opposite end of the spectrum that we just broke ground on. Very small deal, 75 units, 150 beds at Lehigh University. But look, that's an hour from our office. Great, little market. There's a lot of reasons that we like that. But most of our deals are really on the much larger side. Most of our deals are in the 400 to 600 bed type range. We're geographically agnostic, so we've got stuff. We've done a handful of things in upstate New York. That's where we started with two projects in Syracuse. We've since sold both of those. We delivered two projects in upstate New York last summer, in one in Ithaca, one in Rochester. The Ithaca one's kind of a quasi-student, quasi-multifamily building, but we're really all over the country at this point. Like I said, Arizona, we're delivering a project in a couple weeks in Birmingham, Alabama, which is our second one in that market. We're in construction in St. Louis, and then we've got operating assets in Arkansas, Kentucky, South Carolina, and Alabama. We've got one that's operational as well as the in construction.
Wow! Congratulations, it's amazing. I think it is. It's no small feat to be able to grow a development company, even to the scale that you're at currently. And it's a testament to the hard work and probably the acquisition acumen that you have. Let's talk a little bit about that, because people don't understand. I think generally people don't understand the student product, what that acquisition and operation pro forma kind of looks like. Like, why is student an attractive product? Why did you start there? Arguably, really before student was cool. Student's kind of cool now. 10 years ago, wasn't that cool? And yet you were attracted to it anyway. So, can you talk? We'll talk about the operations piece, what it takes to run that company that's student focused. But tell us about like the economics of a student investment, housing investment.
Yeah, so I think we'll back up for a second. I'll tell you how I found student originally, because I think it sort of morphs into everything else, right? So I went to Syracuse, and there was no, at the time, there was no purpose built student housing, right? This is the 2005, didn't really exist, especially in the Northeast. But it was starting to pop up in other places. And two of my friends had sent me links to where they were living at other schools the following year. And I remember seeing these, and it was like, wow, this is amazing, right? It's all brand new appliances. Everyone's got their own bathroom. It's got, great finishes, amenities in the building. What really attracted me to it, I was like, wow, you have hundreds of kids living in one building, right? And being in Syracuse, where it's cold all the time, we still had a good time, but everyone being in one building, I was like, that's really cool. That's really interesting. So I said to my roommate at the time, I was like, we should come back here and build this. And that's actually what we did, 10 years later. But so I worked in real estate for, about, 7-8 years, working for a couple other people, got a master's in real estate development in the middle of that, was not doing student housing. But I was watching the student housing sector the entire time, right? I always knew, as I got interested in real estate, I didn't come from real estate family or background, kind of found it by accident, but was always watching the sector. And when I knew in real estate that I wanted to eventually break off on my own, I was living in New York City, I was from New Jersey. The one thing I kind of figured out early on was I couldn't go to New Jersey and compete, right? You've got families that have been here for 50 years, capital that you just can't compete with, different return profiles. Even when interest rates were zero, right? It was really, really hard to compete with that. And, especially as I was coming out of grad, when I came out of grad school in 2009, a lot of people in my program was in New York City, all wanted to go be developers in New York. And a lot of them were just chasing deals. And I saw that. And in my mindset was always, you can't just chase deals. It's great to do that, but you got to go actually go execute on deals. So student was the thing that I saw as a place you can really go, you can do ground up development. You can make a niche for yourself and you can really go compete. And what really got me going actually is I talked to, you know, some big New Jersey multifamily developers. They all gave me very similar answers, like student housing. I wouldn't touch that with a 10-foot pole. And they were like, well, you lose 100% of your tenants on the same day. They're going to destroy everything. You know, they gave me all these reasons why it's a bad investment. And my mindset was, good, you guys stay away from this. Everything you're saying is completely valid, but there's still a need for it. So there's got to be a workaround to all of that. And that ultimately goes into the operations of all of this and having capable people on the operations side. And, you know, I think for a while, you know, student was a very attractive investment because there was better yield there, right? It was always trading 50 to 150 basis points, you know, more attractive than multifamily. And in my mindset, I looked at that. I'm like, that's crazy, right? Because you have a captive audience. I would argue that it actually should be lower than multifamily. I wasn't complaining about it, that you're getting better returns. But I looked at it and always thought, I'm like, this is a safer investment. So it took a while, right? You know, we had to go educate investors because we weren't doing the institutional side. We raised capital on a syndicated basis. I've got about 650 unique investors on our platform right now. We don't have an institutional partner. And it's kind of fun that way, right? I get to talk to a lot of people all over the country, some of them are all over the world, who get to come and do these deals.
Is that the fun part though, Jared? Is that the fun part, talking to all those people?
When things are going well, yes.
Yeah, right.
Absolutely. When things are going well, absolutely. But look, we want to be transparent with everybody. So things aren't always great, especially, you know, in the last, you know, year or two, there's definitely been some struggles out there. You know, but educating those investors has been, you know, a big undertaking, getting people comfortable with the sector, getting them to understand the demand that's out there. You know, why this asset class makes sense. And I would say, you know, really coming out of the pandemic, it answered a ton of questions that people on the sidelines had, which was, hey, what happens when school goes online, right? What's the impact going to be to the education? What's the impact going to be, you know, as a byproduct of that to student housing? And I would tell you, people inside student housing for years were never worried about that. Like, that was never a concern of mine, because being inside the operations of this and being in these buildings, you saw the culture, you saw people that were there. You understood that that's not going away. The way education is delivered has changed and will absolutely continue to change. But you can't replicate the college experience from your parents' basement, right? It just doesn't happen. So COVID answered a ton of those questions for, you know, that we were able to tell our investors. Like I said, we knew it. It was never a scary part on our side. But being able to show people the statistics, you know, student was probably one of the best, you know, rent collections in the pandemic, right? You know, first, last mile industrial was probably the number one, but student collections were in the high 90s across the board. So things were really good throughout that time. And I think that has really helped people get comfortable with it. And then I would add, you know, the other thing, and I've told them this, is that, you know, the fact that Blackstone came in, you know, and spent $13 billion to buy, you know, the only publicly traded company in our space and take them private, you know, has been a huge, huge windfall for us from the perspective of, I actually now tell investors, I'm like, don't listen to me, right? Forget me. But just go look at Blackstone. They made a $13 billion bet. They have a few other billion dollars spread around, and they didn't do it based on past performance. They're really smart. They did it because they see, you know, the tailwinds and where this sector is going. So I've utilized institutions like that and smarter people to continue to educate our investors.
But the most daunting, I think, task in student housing, and you correct me if I'm wrong, when I talk about how you manage 100% move out in a minor, small period of time, usually the response is crickets from people who don't understand how this happens. Until recently, when there's technology like Leonardo 24/7, but just generally like move in, move out technology has made it easier. But let's talk about that dynamic for a moment. Like, how do you pull off and survive a move out of 100% more or less of your resident base every year?
So are you asking from the financial aspect of it, or more from the operation side? Hey, you've got only a couple elevators and you've got all these people who need to move. And how does that go? So is your question more on the financial side, or more on like the actual, how does this really go down?
Well, great question, because I think the financial side was a bigger challenge when students only doing 9-month leases. I don't know when that switched.
So yeah, so now it's all 12-month leases, right?
Yeah, so that sort of fixed the financial side, right?
That's actually the fallacy in student housing, is that it's not really a 12-month lease, right? And even though we all say it is, what it really is an 11 and a half month term lease. So what the lease will say is, you know, say your rent's $1,000 or advertises $1,000. When you actually go sign the lease, what it will say is you're signing a lease, and I'm just using approximate dates here, from August 1st to July 15th, right? So you get occupancy of that unit for 11 and a half months for the cost of $12,000. But listen, I'm a nice guy. I'm going to make it easy for you. You can make 12 equal payments of $1,000 a month. So August is always a tricky one that people, you know, complain about. Because when, or my scenario, I said August 1st, but usually it's called August 15th to July 31st, is that you really only have occupancy for half that month. So people do complain, you know, about that, but then it's like, well, read the lease, right? Like, we were very clear what the cost is and what this is, and you can't get your keys until you're current on rent. So from the financial side of things, moving to that 12 months or full year term lease, you know, has certainly, you know, changed things. And that I just have to thank the rest of the industry for, right? We didn't do that. That was, I just get the benefit of, you know, a lot of smarter people and a lot of bigger players who have set the tone, right? And it's not just that, right? They've set the tone on a lot of things with, you know, how utilities are reimbursed, you know, what fees, you know, are able to be charged. So the industry has definitely continued to evolve. Now, you want to talk about the operation side of that, or?
I do, but you just reminded me about one other thing, which is unique to the student, because the thing about TURN and the leases. The leases are on a per bed basis, typically, not a per unit. And the aggregate of those per bed leases, give us some sense of the delta you can achieve in per square foot rents versus conventional by parsing it out into these, you know, 2-3 per bed leases.
Yeah, no, absolutely. So, you know, what we see, you know, again, it's certainly going to be market to market dependent, right? You know, depending on where you are, but you know, you're usually seeing rents and call it the high $2 to the mid $4 a square foot range. Obviously, that's a fairly, you know, wide gap right there. But I mean, you don't really see that across the board on, you know, multifamily, right? Multifamily in some of these similar types of markets, you're looking at high dollars, you know, maybe low $2. But as those go up, certainly the area gets better. I mean, Arizona State, for example, we're looking at high threes, low fours per square foot baseless. So it really gets
in a market which would support what on the conventional side?
Probably around like 250 a foot.
Yeah. Incredible. Should we suppress this episode so that people, because once people, I mean, if when people understand the economics of this kind of product type, what keeps them from getting into the market? I meet people all the time, like, I wouldn't do student. Is it just a misperception of the operational piece we're about to talk about on the turn? What do you think it is?
I really do. I think it's the misperception of the operational piece, not just on the turn, but, you know, throughout the entire year, right? People don't, you think about the asset class. And when you think about student housing, the first thing that pops into people's minds is Animal House, right? And that's, you're thinking that's what you're getting if you're buying into this. And it's the complete opposite, you know? And I would tell you, for the most part, you know, there's always going to be exceptions. You got damages, people knock things. But if you give people a good product, they typically will take care of it, right? Not always, you know, and it's still a clientele that you need to dummy proof against, and people do stupid things. Last night, I got an incident report that I was reading for a property that we have in South Carolina. Somebody stole the golf cart and drove it into our pond, through a fence into the pond, right? So, like, things happen, right? Like, you know, in our building in Arkansas a couple years ago, a kid went and just started knocking down all the exit signs. And then he was taking them and storing them in his apartment, which I really don't understand why you're going to keep the evidence of the crime that you committed. But so, look, people do stupid things like that, right? But it's, from my perspective, when we design these buildings, it's almost like you want to baby-proof them and dummy-proof them as much as you possibly can, right? So when you go through it from that perspective, there's a good amount of handholding that needs to go throughout the entire process, right? We got to hold the management company's hand. We got to design it correctly. But I think from the outside investor, they don't know necessarily. They don't want to be on the operational side, right? And I think the average investor is not going to go out there and buy an asset for $50 to $100 million, right? Well, you know, obviously that's a very big range, but you can buy something small, but then you're going to pay up on the operational side, right? So this, to really gain efficiencies, you know, with these operations, typically you need around 400 beds in a building, right? Offset a little bit, that number changes depending on the rent level in a market, but general rule of thumb, when you see 400 beds, you can start to really click off some efficiencies. So the average investor is not going to go buy a building, you know, figure if it's $125,000 a bed, you know, to buy it, that's $50 million. The average guy's not going to go do that. So I think that pushes a lot of people out. And truthfully, that's where we come in, right? Like that's syndicating it out. And we allow those people to invest with us, alongside us, come into our deals. And I think we offer probably the most unique product in the country from that perspective, in that if you want to go invest in the student housing development deal, there's really not many ways to go do that for the average retail investor, right? So they come, a lot of them come to us. I don't know of any other group on the development side that would take checks of $100,000, $200,000, $500,000.
Right, right. Not when you have so much, I mean, that's another, I think, stark contrast with conventional is there's so much institutional capital chasing conventional. There's just like no room for like the small SMB developer investor, just, and there is on the student side. In the last couple of minutes we have remaining, demystify for us a little bit the daunting or maybe not so daunting annual turn.
Yeah. So look, it's a crazy 2 weeks, right? There's no question about it. You got 2 weeks to turn this building. So look, I think the keys to getting that done are, number one, being really well prepared, right? Having the vendors, having everybody in place. And in full disclosure, we don't manage our buildings, right? I like to think we know how to manage the manager very well. We're about as hands-on as an ownership group can be from that perspective. So we know everything that's going on, but we do rely on third-party management companies, though some of the biggest in the country, you know, to really guide that process and push that forward, right? So we rely on that. So I think they take a lot of the burden off of us from a day-to-day piece of that, from a term perspective. But the keys there are really, A, being really well prepared, and that means having the vendors lined up. But more importantly, and I've seen them, you know, all the management companies do this the last couple of years, is they're doing a lot of walks throughout the year, right? They're checking these, you know, when kids go home for Thanksgiving, when they go home for, you know, December break, our teams are walking these, right? So we know, we have a general heads up on, hey, this is the amount of furniture that's going to be damaged and need to be replaced. This is, you know, the types of damages throughout the units that we need to be prepared for. And then the other thing is, you know, as I mentioned, typically that turn is, call it July 15th to August 31st, right? Or whatever 2 week period in there you want to look at. Most kids have left earlier than that, right? So you don't have everybody actually leaving on the same day. The leases may expire on the same day. But in a lot of these markets, kids go home a lot earlier and they'll turn in the keys, right? So we start getting units back in May. So that allows us to, A, walk them and know what it is. Small items, we'll just, you know, the in-house teams can knock out. And then they save the larger items for really that crazy 2 week period. But, you know, again, I think it goes back to our management companies. I'll give them a lot of praise for this, is being very well prepared. And, you know, in the 10 years we've been doing this, obviously we haven't had turns every year. You know, it took a couple of years to get the first building up and figure out how we were going to do that. But in the last, I guess, 7-8 years where we've had turn every year, we've had very few issues, you know, across the board. And I think our management companies have done a phenomenal job, you know, being on top of that, and kudos to our team for giving them the tools to be well prepared.
Better rental rates on a per square foot basis, better collections, better predictable vacancy, and better opportunities to get in as a non-institutional investor. I suspect people will be very interested in talking to you, Jared, when they listen to this episode. Where can we direct people if they're interested in becoming part of your investment platform, part of your syndication group?
Yeah, absolutely. So our website is aptitudere.com, but then we've also set up a website, investwithaptitude.com, where it's a lead capture, right? It's put your information in. That all comes to our team. I see all of it. So, you know, I reach back out directly to everybody. I am our investor's relation at this point. So, and I'm not looking to give that up, right? So I think that gives our investors a lot of, you know, credence to know that at the end of the day, they've got a direct line to the guy spending the money, right? And again, what makes us different from some others is we raise capital for each deal directly, right? So it works out well in that, you know, when you're investing, the actual bricks and sticks that your money is going to. It's not a commingled fund. A lot of our investors treat us like a fund from the perspective of, you send out a deal and they're like, well, what else is coming? I'm going to give you guys X dollars this year. You tell me, is that one deal, two deal, three deals? You know, what's coming out there? But people love knowing the exact deals that they're going into. And my recommendation to everybody is just diversify, whether it's with us or other people. You know, don't assume that every investment is going to be great, right? Because it can't be. Things happen, things change. So I like to tell people to diversify from that perspective, but investwithaptitude.com.
Right on, Professor Hutter. Thank you for joining us today, giving us a little insight into the world of student housing. Really admire the company and the culture you've built there, and appreciate you sharing that with the listeners today.
Thank you.
Thank you for joining us at this week's episode of the Apartment Academy podcast. The Apartment Academy is a production of Leonardo 24/7, the industry's leader in multifamily operations and maintenance software. At Apartment Academy, we realize the hard work that goes into property management and the stress that comes along with it. Leonardo 24/7 takes the guesswork out of your team's day-to-day by providing customized daily guidance on tasks that need to be done, guaranteeing consistent operations across your entire portfolio. To learn more, visit www.leonardo247.com today.